Okay, well, good morning, everyone. So I want to report on some work we've been doing in the last couple of years, and this has been done with some co-workers who I'll acknowledge to start with: Mark Woodhouse, Jerry Phillips, Chris Johnson, Steve Sparks, and Herbert Hubbard. Of course, Chris is in the room. You heard from him on Wednesday. Mark is a mathematician. Jerry Phillips and Steve Sparks are scientists in Bristol. And Herbert Huppert is our latest recruit in Bristol. He's spending the autumn months working in the maths department there. And we're part of a consortium funded by a UK research council called Vanaheim. Well, of course, naming a consortium is perhaps the most difficult thing that you have to come up with. And of course, they always want an acronym. Vanaheim. So it comes from Norse mythology. And Vanaheim is the home to gods who are associated with fertility, wisdom, these are all very good things, and the ability to see the future. So that's why, actually, the abbreviation for it is rather forced for our own particular. So the actual title of our consortium is Volcanic and Atmospheric Near to Far Field Analysis of Plumes, Helping Interpretation and Modeling. Anyway, so what we are, it's a collection of scientists, and the motivation will become very clear in a couple of slides' time, but comprising both people who take field measurements, so when there's an eruption, they will drive out with a LIDAR, or perhaps try and fly an unmanned aircraft into the volcanic cloud. With volcanologists who kind of try and understand processes. And then we're at one extreme, we're kind of the mathematicians getting involved with quantitative modeling. Okay. So to set the focus for the talk today, I'm going to try and split this into two features. So first of all, I'm going to say something about plume rise. So this is a volcano kicking out an ash cloud. It heats the atmosphere, so it's less dense in the atmosphere and rises to some level. That's going to be the plume rise bit. And then it begins to spread. And it begins to spread at the level where its own density has reached the same densities of the surrounding atmosphere. So that's going to be the bit of ash dispersion. So then a very particular motivation is to do with the impact of volcanic ash on aircraft and the risk to aviation. And so you all have guessed that in Europe in 2010 this was a particular issue, and that actually spawned the funding call for which we formed the consortium. So here are two photos of rather extreme situations. The one on the right over here, this is from the Philippines in 1991 at the US Air Force base. And actually, the weight of ash caused this plane to sit down.
Weight of ash?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, exactly. The one on the left is more recently. That's, I think, at an Argentinian airport during the eruption from Chile the year before last. Anyway, so it turns...
The planes both were covered while they were on the ground.
Yes, exactly. They're not flying. They're not flying. But it turns out that... any aircraft flight you make has to receive advice from a volcanic ash advisory center, who look at all aircraft routes and advise as to whether there's going to be any volcanic hazard. And here's how the world is divided up. So I think this must be for historical reasons. So of course, I always focus on UK, and the VAC in London really has responsibility for kind of Northern Europe, but really all the volcanoes are in Iceland.
It's good to see not in the rest of
Europe. exactly. And then France, well, the one in Toulouse has a huge area of responsibility. They're obviously very capable scientists there. Actually, there aren't so many volcanoes in Africa, but there's, of course, Italy has several to worry about. Over this world, it's VAC in Washington. Anchorage is a small patch, but of course there's very active volcanoes up here. Anyway, you get the idea. You'll also see that there's areas of the world, if your aircraft chooses to go through the hatched areas, you've got a lot of trouble because they're not covered by any monitoring. Probably the VAC which is busiest is the one in Darwin.
just over here.
Because it has a responsibility for looking at the all the flights across kind of Philippines, Indonesia. And they issue a number of advisory notes each year. So I've met the manager there, and perhaps they're issuing a couple of thousand of advisory notes each year. So really, they have a very active volcanic systems, and there is significant risk to aircraft flight. Okay, well, the focus of the story today is going to be about Iceland and the eruption in 2010, which was from down here. But this is just to show the background to it. So the Mid-Atlantic Ridge kind of rises, goes right through the center of Iceland. And Reykjavik is in the left here, in the west. And there are many volcanoes which historically have been active. Actually, the one that erupted in 2010, it was a very small eruption. And so potentially we should expect more eruptions and of larger scale. And so actually the picture to disruption to aircraft is that maybe we've just been lucky for the last decade or so, when aircraft flights have significantly increased, but there's been a decrease in Icelandic volcanism. In particular, these two are the ones which people are currently worried about, Hekla and Katla, whose eruptions are normally associated, follow the Aya eruption. And so these are the ones which are very heavily monitored at the moment. Okay, so what happened in 2010? Well, it was a fairly long-lived eruption, April to May, 6 weeks or so. And it turned out that actually the forecasters did not have the operational tools to predict the behavior. Here's a satellite image of the volcanic plume coming off. And you can see it forms this fairly coherent cloud, which was maybe getting up to 9 or 10 kilometers in the atmosphere. Another thing that happened is during the eruption period, the UK government changed its policy about whether you were allowed to fly or not. So originally the policy was that if there was any ash around, no flights were allowed. And that's a very simple rule to enforce. If there's an eruption, you can't fly. But then under various pressures, perhaps it was pressure from airlines, perhaps other pressures, they then said, well, actually what we want now is to have a threshold value. And so there was a concentration introduced that if the concentration of ash exceeds 2 milligrams per cubic meter, then you can't fly. So this is a rather small concentration. But it totally changes the types of predictions that you need to make. And so it's made the problem much harder to analyze, because we actually need to understand how ash gets transported around and how its concentration evolves. You might ask, how is this figure arrived at? And I might ask that as well. I don't really know. I think it arrived at over one weekend in May in 2010. Is there any data? Well, so there have been, historically, perhaps a couple of instances where engines have lost, where aircraft have lost their engines mid-flight. There was a famous, and one of the most famous is over Indonesia on June 1982. When a British Airways Boeing 747 lost all four engines. I was going to read you what the pilot announced to his passengers. Very understated British man, obviously. he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. We have a small problem. All four engines have stopped. We are doing our damnedest to get them going again. I trust you are not in too much distress."
There will be free drinks.
Yes, that's right. So what happened was actually that airplane it lost all its power, and it went into a kind of free fall. It went into a long glide. It actually set the record for the longest glide ever attained. And as they got down, they managed to restart. The engines. They had to kill one of them again because it was behaving oddly, but then they had still enough to make a landing. There has been
Do we know what this concentrate? So I'm thinking about snow and rain. Are there comparable concentrations in a rainstorm?
So I think it's a different issue. So the problem with ash is that, or this is as explained. The problem with ash is that when it is ingested into the jet engine is at such a high temperature, perhaps 800 degrees in 1982, perhaps 1,000 degrees these days, that the ash melts. And then it re-adheres on the outlet of the engine. And that causes the aerodynamic properties of the engine to change, which then often causes it to spark out.
So totally different.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So perhaps it causes it to spark out and catch fire. And that was also a case of what happened in a flight coming into Alaska in 1989. A new plane, a KLM Boeing 747, caught fire. The engines caught fire. And again, they managed to descend and restart them. There are no quotations from the Dutch pilot. this figure, so where does 2 milligrams per cubic meter come from? It is estimated that the two instances, the BA flight and the KLM flight, perhaps encountered something like 100 times this. And so I think this number really was, well, what's the safety factor? Let's divide it by 100. And that's really, I think, the whole scientific basis for it. Of course, what you'd like to have is better experiments. You'd like someone to take an engine and rain ash into it until you trash it. But that's kind of, that's not been done. And perhaps it's too expensive to do.
Yeah, I mean, according to what you say, it should not just be how large is the concentration of ash, but also how long you fly.
That's right, the dosage. Yeah, you might have.
It seems to be an accumulative effect, according to what you say.
Exactly. So here's the estimated cost to the European economy from this ban on aircraft flight. How do we normalize 5 billion? It's estimated that if an airliner had flown and crashed, the total cost would have been 1.5 billion. In cost of the plane, cost of all the insurance payouts, and so on. So then I guess, is 5 billion a big number or not? Well, we're not politicians, so we don't have to make that assessment. Okay. Anyway. That's the motivation for the science that we've been trying to do in the last few years, to try and improve our modeling and understanding of the rise of these plumes and then how they spread.
Have any planes actually crashed because of the ash?
Not airliners, not big jets. I think there have been smaller ones. Okay, so one of the things we're going to want to know is what's the mass flux from a volcano. So when it's erupting, how many particles is it putting out into the atmosphere? Because no matter how we choose to then model its subsequent dispersion once it's reached a neutral level, we're going to want to know the rate of input. And of course, that's rather difficult to measure. I mean, you can't really think of any instrumentation which you could directly use to measure it. So what's done is that people measure how high it goes in the atmosphere and then use models to relate the height of rise to the source flux. So let's have a think about how this might work. So what I'm sketching here is height, and this is density, and we might imagine the environmental density decreasing with height. We have a stratified ambient, stratified environment. And so if the volcano erupted and just ascended without doing any mixing with the environment, well, it would go up until its density matched the environmental density, and then it would spread at that height. That would be like what a hot air balloon would do. Of course, you can see that volcanoes don't do that. As they ascend, this plume does lots of mixing with the surroundings, and so it's bringing on fluid which is denser than itself, and so its density increases. And so here we are, might see how the plume density is increasing as we go up with height, and it spreads at some level where its density right now matches the environmental density. And what I'm going to show you, and maybe this is the crux to the first part, is that actually wind increases the rate of mixing. And so for the same source strength, this thing, this volcano, this source, mixes more rapidly and so intrudes at a lower height. Okay. So then, how do we relate the height of rise to flux? So this is what was done. I'm explaining the data. So this is observations of plume height. And this is situations where people have, after the eruption, calculated what was the source mass flux. Of course, this is a difficult calculation to do, but what you might imagine doing is going and measuring the deposit and then estimating the amount of particles that have landed on the floor, and then relating that, dividing that by time, and you get a rate of eruption. And so that's all the data, these data points. Ignore the color coding for the time being. And then what is done is people have fitted empirical curves through this relation, through this data. So we hear there's two versions, virtually the same correlation, relating the height to the flux to about the 1/4 power. What we did was to try and look at this data and then do some reanalysis of what were the wind speeds at that eruption site. And so that's our color coding. We then went through each of these data points, and where we could work out what the wind speed was, we then color coded them accordingly. And you might see, depends how good you are at looking at data, if you squint enough, you might see that increasing wind speed is tends to shift the data points below the lines, indicating that it's more mixing. But we'll see this coming out of the model.
Sorry, I'm not familiar with what happens in the atmosphere, but what happens is that we are very high, so the wind speed is uniform. So the profile of the wind is uniform.
We'll see it in a couple of slides' time, but that's the wrong one. If I draw here, you can see. So this what's known as a standard atmosphere. Okay. And we'll be making some calculations in this context. In fact, it might be known as the US standard atmosphere, where the wind speed has this profile. So it's a linear shear up to the tropopause and then above. So this is the tropopause, which is 10 kilometers.
How important is it to factor the temperature of the plume in? Because the density of the plume is not just a function of the particle loading, but also of the temperature.
Yes, well, in fact, actually, it's entirely driven by temperature. It turns out the particles don't do much other than provide the heat source, which then gets transferred almost straight away to the air. And there's other things. So that could be an effect. If volcanoes were producing particles at different temperatures, that could be a feature here. Also, what's not accounted for here at all is the differences in what the atmosphere is like. So this is all data, including stuff from, Iceland and Alaska, and also stuff from the from Indonesia, where the atmosphere has got a rather different stratification. We'll come back to that. Why might this be approximately 1/4 power? And actually, we can kind of rationalize that. So if we say that these plumes are controlled by how much buoyancy we inject, this gives us a buoyancy parameter. If you like, one way of thinking about this is the rate at which we are, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. We're going to talk about a reduced gravity, a G prime, which measures the density difference times gravity divided by some normalizing density. So what I mean by buoyancy flux is a mass is a volume flux multiplied by G prime. So that's why it's got the units of length to the 4 to the -3. And then also we have a buoyancy frequency. And if we say that, so the buoyancy frequency, again, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself, n squared, is minus the gradient of the atmosphere times gravity divided by normalizing density. So n squared characterizes the stratification in the atmosphere. So if we say our situation is characterized by these two parameters, then there's one height scale that we can form by dimensional analysis. And so then the height would go like the buoyancy flux, or if you like, the mass flux to the 1/4 power. So we might understand why it should be approximately 1/4. But we'll see this emerging from the ring. Okay, so now I want to say a few words about plume modeling. So really this goes back to a very old paper, Morton, Taylor and Turner in 1956, where they introduced the concepts which you might use to model the ascent of a buoyant plume. So here we are, here's variables, defined some of these before. So this is going to be the plume density, the atmospheric density, and n squared is the buoyancy frequency. It characterizes the stratification of the ascent. So the way we model it, or way Morton, Taylor and Turner modeled it, was to say, well look, what we're going to do is think about an average. We're going to average over turbulent fluctuations. So the rise of this plume is then going to be some kind of conical shape. And what we want to do is calculate the radius of this cone and its velocity. And the key feature is that as it goes up, it's drawing environmental fluid in. The action of the turbulent eddies on the interface are to draw fluid in. So then they write down, and this is what they did in 56, expressions for mass conservation, momentum conservation, and buoyancy conservation. So let's just run through these. So mass conservation, this would be the spatial gradient of the mass flux, and it's balanced by the rate at which you entrain. UE is the rate at which you're bringing stuff in over the side boundaries. A momentum balances the divergence of the momentum flux with the buoyancy.
There's just no momentum associated with entrainment?
No. It's a flux which is, it's a horizontal flux. It doesn't bring vertical momentum. And there's no pressure forces in it. And then they write down a buoyancy conservation, and this really is just a density balance equation. And it tells you how the reduced gravity, or rather the density difference between the plume and the environment, changes.
The entraining fluid, though, the momentum to accelerate, that's included in here.
That's right. Yes, because it's a d by dz, or the total momentum flux. Okay. So with this simple system, just to illustrate how it might behave, we might imagine imposing some source conditions at z equals zero, where we just impose buoyancy flux. So we say that this quantity is just equal to some constant b. And then the simplest problem would be to have that the momentum and mass flux is 10 to zero as z tends to zero. And the key assumption is that the entrainment velocity, the rate at which the mixing occurs at the side boundaries, the entrainment velocity is proportional to the upward velocity, with some entrainment coefficient k. And this really, you can view this in some ways. One way of viewing this is that a typical velocity scale of those eddies at the side of the plume is set by the rise velocity of the plume. And there's no other velocity scale around. So this then closes the model, and this is what Morton, Taylor and Turner did in 56. And here's some solutions. If I think about what happens in a situation where the buoyancy frequency is constant, we then see that our only parameters, dimensional parameters in the problem, are n squared and b, the buoyancy frequency and the initial buoyancy flux. So we have just one length scale and one time scale, and we can non-dimensionalize our equations with that. And here's some typical solutions. So z increasing up, you see that the radius, actually let's look at the reduced gravity first. So the different density difference between the environment and the plume decreases until eventually it passes through zero. And at that point, the plume is no longer buoyant, but it keeps on going because it's got inertia. The velocity, this reddish curve, well, this decreases, and it's because it still has upward velocity when you pass through neutral buoyancy that you go up to, you keep on ascending until the velocity drops to zero. And the width keeps on growing because we keep on mixing in environmental fluid. That's the action of turbulence. So here's a picture of Mount Redoubt in in Alaska. And really, this has some of the features that might be in this calculation. We see a plume which is growing in width. It reaches some neutral level where its density now matches the environment density, and the cloud then spreads sideways. However, there's also a little bit of inertial overshoot. So this picture is unfortunately complicated by other intrusions which have happened. But just think about the main cloud, and that's essentially embodied in this solution. So of course there's no wind here. What we want to see is what happens when we put wind in. Well, when we do put wind in, what happens is that the axis of the plume gets bent over. And so now we just need to think a little bit more carefully about how we write down conservation expressions. And so we're going to formulate them in terms of an arc length S and an angle which measures the how much the plume is bent over. So this is theta. And all the variables in this integral model are going to be modeled as a function of S. We're going to measure how much how the velocity varies, the width varies, the angle, the inclination, or the amount of bend in the plume varies, and how its density is reduced. So as well as thinking about vertical momentum conservation, we've got to think about horizontal momentum conservation, because now the wind, as it gets entrained, has some appreciable momentum we've got to consider. So we have mass conservation, momentum in the vertical, momentum in the horizontal. And then this is our version of buoyancy conservation. And this really expresses what Eckhart was asking about, is that we have that the particles have come up, they've heated the plume to a certain temperature. And so this is an expression of energy conservation. So we have the total energy of the plume, which is has a thermal component, kinetic energy, and a potential energy, and how that evolves due to mixing processes with the environment. Okay. So these are our three, our four now conservation principles. And then we have to modify, that's what I'm trying to say, our entrainment assumption. And that's because there's no longer just the one velocity scale, the upward plume velocity, but there's a second velocity scale due to the wind. And so we have a modified entrainment velocity featuring an extra component due to the wind.
Why are they added together like this? Why isn't it the square root of the
So it turns out there are many formulations. This one was proposed in the early 70s by Fay and Holt and tested in a wind tunnel. It's for small-scale experiments. And this one seems to be able to reproduce their lab experiments. But you're right, this is entirely empirical, and there's no reason why a different representation couldn't do. In fact, what I'm going to say doesn't depend crucially on exactly how you represent it. But the point is you need to modify the amount of mixing because there is this extra velocity scale.
Excuse me, what is usually the scale of the upward velocity compared to the scale of the lateral wind?
So the wind might reach 30 meters a second or so at the tropopause.
Might be comparable.
That's right. Yes, so in fact, the plume, the Aya plume, was very strongly bent over. Okay, its vertical rise speed was relatively weak compared to the wind speed. But there are other eruptions, and I'll show some pictures in a bit, where the vertical rise speed far exceeds the wind speed, and basically it goes straight up. Yeah.
What is the order of magnitude of the eruption velocity?
So. 80 meters a second would not be unreasonable. But it is a range, I mean. Depends on your situation.
Difficult to measure.
You've got to be brave to measure. Yeah. And actually, that's part of what these other people in the consortium are doing. They're building these unmanned mini aircraft, which you just fly in and try and take measurements. And these devices, you know, are perhaps £1,000 or so, and they can carry a couple of kilos. And so they're instrumenting them in a way that they don't mind if they lose them. And the idea is that you fly them by remote control and try and take measurements of rise speed, particle concentration, temperatures, and all the kind of things that we'd really like to know. Okay, so anyway, this is our system of equation. Oh, and here's the picture of the standard atmosphere. So this is what how the atmospheric temperature varies typically, decreases in the troposphere, then we've got a constant region and increases again in the stratosphere, and we can convert this to what it means for a density. And then the wind speed increases linearly in the troposphere and is very plug-like. Okay, so what we can do, we can take these equations modeling volcanic plumes and integrate them, and we're asked how high do they rise as a function of how strong the source is. And this is what we've done. So this is then overlying calculations when there is no wind. These are our dots on the data and the empirical curves. And we're spanning reasonable parameter values. So for each source mass flux, we're determining the height of rise. But we're spanning reasonable source temperatures and other parameters. Oh, and what I didn't mention, in our model formulation, we can also allow for moisture content as well. And that would mean you have an extra conservation equation where you have to account for phase changes. But we can do that. So that's why these are shown as a collection of points for each source mass flux, because we're actually spanning values. And what we see, and this is good news, is that the empirical curves more or less follow, or the calculation is close to the empirical curves, and it's kind of in the middle of the data. Okay. So that's when there's no wind. And then what happens as we begin to increase the wind? So we're varying the wind speed at the tropopause. Here we are. I've now got four sets where the wind speed is 10 meters, 20 meters, 30 meters, and 40 meters a second. And what you can see is that the height of rise for a fixed for a fixed mass flux systematically decreases. So let's have a look. If we're at 10 to the 6, as your wind speed increases, your height of rise would go down from about 10.5 kilometers systematically down. And this is kind of what I was trying to show in the initial sketch. The wind increases the mixing, and so for a given source flux, it doesn't go as high.
So that's the dominant, it's not that it directly affects the momentum or something, it's just that
the mixing. Of course, mixing also affects the momentum balance as well. Yes,
the direct effect is there's an extra velocity gradient. So.
Yeah. Okay. So how might we measure the wind speed? And actually, this was a calculation we were trying to do to improve upon the empirical curves that Sparks had got and that Maston had got separately. Well, it turns out that the new parameter we have is at least for plumes which don't go much beyond the tropopause, is this shear rate. So we have a shear rate, which I'm going to call gamma, and shear rate divided by buoyancy frequency, and that's dimensionless, and this is telling us really how strong the wind is. And so what we've tried to do is come up with a new empirical formula where we have this part is the bit that was proposed already, and then we're going to modify it by some function which is now a function of this wind speed parameter. And the reason we've done this is to try and provide an extra a revised empirical formula which the forecasters could use straight away if they didn't want to solve differential equations, and they don't always want to do that. Okay, and this is really just to convince you that this empirical formula works. So here we are. Here's our curves, and here's our data, and we can see that we can well reproduce the model output. Okay, now some of you might be thinking, well, plumes, is it ever appropriate to look at these average profiles, these average widths, averaging over the scale of the turbulence? So here's some photos from a webcam set up, I think, about 50 kilometers or so away from the eruption. It's actually an installation by a mobile phone company, Orange, I think. And they produced they were just capturing images every 10 seconds or so. And so what we can do is to take each of these images from the eruption and then average them. And so actually here's the type of boundaries of the plume that we find. And actually the predictions from our model do quite well. We can capture the shape pretty well. Okay, now what does this mean for the interpretation of the Aia eruption? So I'm going to focus on a period which was at the start of the eruption, between the 14th and 17th of April. And here's observations of how high the plume went. So these were taken by firing a radar in from the airport at Reykjavik and looking at the reflected signal. And it seems as if the plume height, well, some of the time it's going up to about 9 kilometers, and then it would drop and really go up to about 5 or so, and then it would go back up to 9. So just over 3 days, there was a big variation in the height at which to which the plume rose. And so, if you just use the sparks and Mastin curves, these were the relationships between the height of rise and the flux of particles, then it will mean that the volcano is delivering a flux of particles which is very substantially changing over these 3 days. So here's our, if you take this and you put it into the formulae, well, I think the red curve is the sparks one, the blue one is the Mastin one. And so we're getting 10 to the 6 kilograms per second, and then it drops down to 2 times 10 to the 5, and drops a bit lower, and then goes back up to 10 to the 6. Okay. And I want to emphasize that these are then needed for then calculating the subsequent dispersion, because these are the rate at which the volcano is putting particles into the atmosphere. So if you want to work out the concentration over Heathrow, you need to know what your source strength is over Iceland. Yeah.
Well, it's the estimated uncertainty in the mass flux. That must be pretty big, I think.
So this is calculated just by using the empirical formulae of sparks and Mastin. And so really, the question, I suppose, is what's the uncertainty in measuring this radar height?
What is the uncertainty in the empirical formula?
Oh, well, that just fits through that data. And so pretty large, actually. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure, but if you go back to the video of the orange company, I mean, the just a slide before.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that what happens to the, I mean, when the wind is rather strong, like in this case, you have a different phenomenon for entraining the ambient air. Usually when a jet is going upward, I mean, there is an entrainment which you can scale with the usual theories, but when there's a crosswind, so you have a jet in crosswind, so then what happens is that the average picture is at least is exactly that one. I'm not sure if the scale is applied, but we've been working with jets in crosswind that on very tiny scales, and what happens is that you create huge vortices, which induce an enormous amount of mixing, which is different from the big rollers which entrain the fluid.
So I think the headline will be the same, that the amount of mixing is increased through these big rollers.
Yeah.
So the question is whether we're getting the same vortical structures or not. I don't know. I don't know. Okay, so this would be the interpretation of the radar data if you used the correlations which don't account for wind. And so you get this picture of this volcano jumping around, right? So suddenly doing something and then it would jump down and then it jump back up again. So now let's look at what the wind is doing on those days. So we have radio sonde measurements at various instances. So this is on the same time axis for days. And we can see that the wind, we're having a low wind period, then a period of high wind, and the wind speed drops again. And overlaid on that, I've put crosses which are from a numerical model. If we see what the output of the numerical model was on those days, weather prediction. UM is the Met Office Unified Model Data, UK Met Office. And so basically the radio sonde measurements are capturing what was seen in the numerical model. And then we look at the plume height, and we can more or less see that at low winds, it's going higher than it is at high winds. And of course that's what we expect, if we now think that wind increases mixing. So here's a reinterpretation that we performed. So here again is our wind speed. And here's the output of our model. So if we just say, well, let's imagine the volcano doesn't change its output flux at different times, but holds a constant flux throughout this period. This is this black solid line. And then here's the output of our model, either the green crosses or the green crosses or the purple crosses. And we can see we already start to reproduce the data a little bit better, the variation. But then if we say, well, let's say we allow the volcano to have minor fluctuations about this constant value, then we can really very well reproduce the variation in the height of the plume. And so this then is our interpretation of actually what was happening. the variations in the rise height of the cloud were not due to the volcano decreasing its flux by a factor of 10 or something. It was due to the wind speed varying, wind speed inducing more mixing, and so the volcanic cloud didn't rise as high. And actually, let's look at the values here. So we will find that we can fit our model pretty well with a flux getting close to 10 to the 7. If you use the Sparks data, we're kind of down at 10 to the 5 or so. So actually, our interpretation is that the mass flux may actually be 100 times greater than what was used in the subsequent dispersion modeling. So already we should start getting worried, right? We've got potentially a factor of 100 here by just accounting properly for the mixing. The threshold value, well, we think perhaps that was pitched by dividing what was dangerous by 100. And so we're already getting close to threshold. What we did then was then put this revised source strength into the atmospheric dispersion modeling that the Met Office was using. Numerical Atmospheric Dispersion Modeling Environment. This was the tool the UK Met Office were using to calculate where the ash was going. This tool was actually developed from days when they were worried about radioactive fallout from Russian reactors. And they were modified it to try and account for volcanic ash particles. So we put our revised estimates, and then we measured what the concentration field was. So if we just didn't, if we used the approach that they did and calculated what were the concentration of ash, allowing for the source of the volcano to be fluctuating in this way, this would be our calculation of where the ash went. So this is color-coded, so blue is safe, green is kind of marginal, and red is dangerous. And so really, the only dangerous fly zones were close to Iceland. But if the volcano source strength was 100 times greater, which we think the data was showing, then actually the zones which were dangerous for flying was much more extensive.
And I missed that 100 times greater inference. Can you do?
Yeah. So what we're doing here, we saw that high plume heights were associated with low wind speeds, and low plume heights were associated with high wind speeds. And that's what our modeling would suggest. So what we then tried to do was to fit our model to produce predictions for how high the plume went. So, and what we did, we input the wind speed. So if we do the black line here, this is saying that our volcano was at this constant strength throughout the period, but the wind was varying in time. That gives us these green and purple data, which already is not doing too badly in following the measured heights. If we allow a slight variation about this constant value, then we can really match the data very well. These are these red circles. And so our conclusion would be that actually the volcano wasn't changing its source strength over a few days. The volcano was behaving more or less constantly. And it's the wind that was varying.
But where does 100 times greater come from?
Okay, so our deduced values here are 10 to the 7. If I go back to, if you just use the empirical curves, you're kind of down at 10 to the 5.
How sensitive is that to the closure of the entrainment?
Not particularly. I mean, so we checked a span of values. Yeah. But as soon as you begin putting some in, then it doesn't hugely depend on the range. I mean, of course, if you take extreme values,
it's not that K or whatever it was, it's an extra degree of freedom that you can use to get this heat discharge.
Yeah. Well, of course it is, because it's another parameter in the problem.
Yeah.
But the values we put in are the ones which were proposed from the experiments in the 70s. So the ones which seem to match lab data. But of course you could explore a range of it and examine the consequences. But taking the kind of literature values, this is what we find.
Can you tell us here, I'm not quite sure, where does the second lower band come from? I see the upper one originating there.
These values, do you mean these color codes?
No. It seems like they're two sources there.
Yeah, so here and here?
No, just the wind pattern.
The
wind is not continuous.
Next slide.
There.
There.
Oh, why is it doing this?
Yeah.
So so it's the panel of view, right? So it's a weather system which was doing this kind of thing. And the thing which made it really a persistent problem over the 6 weeks was that the winds over a long period were in this direction. And that's moderately unusual, that it was a fixed weather pattern. Yeah.
Did you use, for this calculation, did you use the wind speed and the plume height in the surroundings of the volcano or in Reykjavik, or did you use it at different places?
So we used it at the volcano, and we used a numerical weather prediction model to produce the, we used the unified model from the UK Met Office to produce at volcano values.
And could the development of the plume over longer distances could give you any independent confirmation of the parameters that you're putting in?
You mean the entrainment parameters?
Especially that I'm thinking about the mass flux, right?
So, not really, because even once the ash plume is entirely airborne, there at that stage were not good ways of deducing anything about concentrations within it. So nowadays people can investigate by satellite ash concentrations to some extent, although it's rather coarse. But in 2010 that wasn't possible.
Okay.
So anyway, that's the end of part one. Part two is about when it's reached its neutral level and begins to spread horizontally within the atmosphere. And that's what I want to say something about now, the intrusion. Okay. And actually this slide is really to make the point, I think I was asked about it, is isn't wind always dominant? And the point is actually not necessarily. You can be in a situation where the wind is relatively weak compared to the strength of the volcano. And that's when you get what is known as an umbrella cloud. So the volcano erupts and spreads essentially radially away from source, because the wind is insufficient to cause any significant deflection from that radial symmetry. And here's a couple of photos of the umbrella clouds at Lasca in 1993, that's in Chile, which went up to 23 kilometers, and then Mount St. Helens. Okay. And why is it called an umbrella cloud? I don't really know. The best answer I've heard from Steve Sparks is that it looks like an umbrella. I don't know, I'm looking at a geologist.
You probably don't want to call it a mushroom cloud.
Oh, you don't want to call it a mushroom cloud, that would be something else, yes. Okay. So now here's one thing we're going to try and model in is these spreading layers. And here's some more recent satellite data on spreading ash layers. So this is an eruption in Chile in 2012, and this is 600 kilometers downwind of the plume. And the point, and this data is gathered by looking at retrievals from satellites, and then they've developed some new algorithms to try and back out the ash concentration. And the point is, I'm showing this, is that actually this layer is pretty thin. We're a long way from plume, but perhaps it's only a few hundred meters thick. And that's kind of surprising. Although actually those brave pilots that did fly during 2010 around Iceland reported thin ash cloud layers. So this data is coming from a guy called Fred Prater. And I need to look at, he wrote something down earlier. If you read this week's Nature, he is just about to trial something. So on the 28th of October, he's going to trial a new detector for onboard ash detection on aircraft. So this is a large-scale experiment he's doing, if the weather is calm enough, in the Bay of Biscay. Is that right? Southern Europe somewhere. Where he's going to have one aircraft fly in front and rain ash out. And then his second aircraft, with his infrared detector, is going to fly behind and see if they can pick up what the concentration of ash is. And so this might be a way for avoiding... Anyway. When he's not doing that, he works on satellites and he produced this data. And the reason I show it is to show that it's a thin layer. So now let's think. The Met Office model, the NAME model, which was used to model ash dispersion, was essentially a model based on diffusion. So it was carried around by the wind speed and diffused through some turbulent processes. And so we could think about, well, what would be a very simple way of capturing that? If phi would be the concentration, well, we'd have advection by the wind speed, settling, and then some type of diffusivity. Here I've shown it to be homogeneous, but we could imagine it not be the case with some source. And then the question is, well, what would that do? So if I just were to sketch out an isosurface of concentration coming from the source, going downwind in the vertical, we'd have this kind of we'd have this surface which is thickening with distance. And of course, that's what diffusion does, right? I mean, we kind of understand that. Diffusion must thicken your cloud layer. So in particular, it's hard to reconcile where these thin layers come from. And that's what we'd like to try and examine. And it seems as if it's an ingredient which is not included in any currently used operational models of ash dispersion. Okay. So now we need to think about, what is the cloud doing to the atmospheric density? So we have this picture. The plume has risen up to its neutral buoyancy level and then begins to spread horizontally. So the environment has a linear stratification. The density decreases linearly with height. And the plume is delivered at its neutral level. So it's delivered at the level at which it has the same density. And what it does is mixes up the fluid over the thickness of the intrusion. Okay, so it's delivering up, it's intruding at its neutral level, so at the same density, but it's got a certain thickness. So what we've done, we've perturbed the atmospheric stratification. It turns out the particles actually don't add much to the density of these ash clouds at all. They're pretty dilute. By the time you get up to the neutral levels, we estimate they might be as small as one part in a million or something in terms of volume loading. Okay, so the thickness H is going to turn out to play a role, and this determines how much the pressure within the intruding layer, within this layer, is exceeding the hydrostatic balance. And it's going to be gradients of this hydrostatic pressure that drive the motion. And in fact, we can understand this very easily. So there's two ways of thinking about it. We could either think of particles at the top here, which are now denser than the surroundings, and so they want to flow back down. And particles at the bottom are less dense than the surroundings, so they want to rise up. And so this is a mechanism which is going to thin these layers. And so this is the key feature. There's these buoyancy processes, which potentially can... Nice to have some musical accompaniment. But it can thin the layers, whereas diffusion must thicken it. Okay. Another way of thinking about it is what we're doing here. This is stirring up the atmospheric stratification. And so within the intrusion, then, we're storing potential energy, which is released as it collapses back down again. And again, that's a mechanism for thinning. So how this model is going to work, we're going to have gradients of the perturbations of the hydrostatic pressure gradient are related to gradients in the thickness. And this is a mechanism for driving the flow. So actually, this puts us in a world which is rather similar to particle-laden gravity currents. But here, rather than having a dense layer, say, at the bottom of a flow, this is riding at its neutral level, and it's the thickness of the flow which is driving it. Okay, so here's a model we're going to look at. It's going to be a shallow layer in the atmosphere. So a side view. Here's our volcano come up, erupted, and created an intrusion. Looking in plan view, we have this cloud which is going downstream in the x direction and continuing to spread in the lateral direction. And so what we can do is express mass conservation for the shallow layer. And then here's two expressions for momentum balance. So the downstream one and the cross-stream one. And we put the interaction with the wind through some kind of drag terms, which are based on the square of the velocity difference between the flow speed and the wind speed. With some drag coefficient. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to run through a series of problems here. And the first one we might imagine is, let's say there's no drag, there's no wind. Can we understand the radially spreading case? So this would be pertinent to the umbrella cloud. Okay, so in this case, we have radial coordinates, and so mass balance takes this radial form. And here is momentum balance. I've missed out a factor of r within that bracket. And we want to solve these equations subject to a source condition. So at some radius, we impose some input mass flux. And then at the front of these clouds, we've got to have a different condition. It can't just be a flow, it can't just be a shallow flare. And so we impose a condition, a frontal condition, between the radial velocity and the local velocity scale. This would be analogous to the so-called Froude condition in basal gravity currents. So what do the solutions to this system with these boundary conditions look like? And if you look in the literature, the expectation would be that the radial front position spreads like q times n times t squared all to the 1/3 power. In other words, the radius grows like t to the 2/3. And actually, that's rather easy to understand. And this would be the expectations. So you'd say, well, the mass flux must always be like rh times ur. And that goes like q, because we have a constant mass flux. The dynamics tell us that the radial velocity must go like nh. And by kinematics, the radial velocity must go like r over t. So you eliminate between those, and you find that r cubed goes like qn t squared. And this is what people have been doing for the last 15 years or so. So it turns out that that's not the situation. So when you numerically solve these, and I'm going to now go into dimensionless units, using 1 on n as the time scale, and the length scale is going to be q over n to the 1/3 power. And for volcanic eruptions, q is huge. So we've got very big length scales here. So Reynolds numbers are huge. Okay, and this is what the profile looks like. Let's look first of all at the one on the left. So this is the thickness as a function of radius at different times. Okay, so this is at different subsequent snapshots of time. We find that the flow develops some kind of interior jump. And across the jump, we just conserve mass flux and momentum flux. And then how does the radius spread? So this is the radius minus its initial value. And it seems to be spreading like t to the 3/4, not t to the 2/3, which is what the scaling would admit. Okay, and don't worry so much about that lower relationship. I'll get to that in a bit. And so what's gone wrong with the scaling analysis? And what's gone wrong with it is that the solution is developing a steady tail. You can see that at subsequent times here, it's laying down a tail which is always the same, and all the unsteadiness is related, is restricted to a much thinner region at the front. And when people had done these these scaling analysis to deduce t to the 2/3 for the spreading rule, that's not the solution structure they had in mind. They had necessarily thought that there would be time dependence throughout the whole domain. But that's not what we find when we solve the equation. From a steady source, it lays down a steady tail, and all the time dependence is in an unsteady region at the front.
There's a second shock in the solution from behind the head.
Yeah, that's right. Let's look at this one. Yeah, so this is the front, and then the solution always develops a jump.
What's the physics there?
So, why does it develop a jump, or what's happening at the jump?
Both.
Okay, so what's happening at the jump is so when we allow jumps to develop across which mass is conserved and momentum flux is conserved. So the normal kind of one-layer conservation expressions. Okay, and then it emerges from the numerical calculations because they're written in flux conservation form. So that's why they are written in flux conservation form, and so they admit solutions which are the hyperbolic systems, and so they admit discontinuous solutions.
Physically, at and this shock, don't you expect a massive amount of mixing?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's going to change everything.
Yeah, that's right. So there could be local processes. And in fact, whenever you have a shock in a shallow layer system, actually, what we're doing is kind of we're zooming out and we're representing processes which aren't getting the details right close to the shock. But nevertheless, in general conservation terms, all that's happening across the shock is that mass flux is being conserved and momentum flux is being conserved. So why is it arising?
Yeah.
It's because we're asking that it hits a certain Froude number at the front, and behind it, it's becoming more and more supercritical, and so there has to be a jump to connect the two.
Can anyone see that in observations of Froude?
I think I've no idea. But I don't think people have looked for it.
But those equations, they're exactly the same for gravity currents. So in
exactly
a way, this is like this is the head and this is the tail.
Exactly.
And you do get this
exactly
drop off.
Exactly. So the question is, can we understand this t to the 3/4 power? And actually, we can. And the argument might go like this. So really, what we've got is a steady tail, and all the unsteadiness now is at some frontal region, which is going to, I'm going to call this thickness delta r. And within the motion, the steadiness has a constant mass flux, and we have kind of energy conservation. And because it's stratified now, our Bernoulli constant would feature an h squared. If we were in a regular gravity current, it would just be h. And so at large distances, what's the behavior of these? Well, the height decreases like 1 r, and the velocity becomes an order 1 number. So we get the steady tail progressively thins and reaches a constant velocity. Okay, and it's connected to the unsteady front via a shock across which, and here's the conservation expressions across a shock, conservation of mass speed, mass flux, c is the shock speed, and this is the momentum flux expression. So this is the effective term, this is the pressure term. Okay, so those must hold. And so at large radius, this tells, the first one tells us that the shock speed basically goes at the same speed as the front. And then the momentum balance must tell us that there's a balance between the pressure, or the integrated pressure at the front, and the momentum flux that is delivered into the front. So these follow just by looking at the what happens at large radius to these jump conditions. And as soon as we get that, we can see that we can now know the far-field behavior of the, so we know the stuff on the minus side, the stuff that's coming in from these conditions. So this tells us h cubed goes at 1 r on r. But at the front, we must have u goes like h, that's the Froude number condition. And so between these, this tells me that radius must grow like 2 to the 3 quarters. So actually, we can understand the rule. And then how do we get the width of this unsteady front? Well, we can just apply mass balance. And so we must have that the width times the radius times the height grows linearly in time because it's a constant flux. And so the width grows at 2 to the half.
So the unsteady arc is getting longer over time. Is it also getting, what happens with the height of the unsteady part?
Yeah, so well, you can see the height here. So the height is diminishing in time. Yeah. The unsteady part is getting longer, like t squared, but the total current is getting longer, like t to the 3 quarters. So as a proportion of the total current, it's getting smaller, because it's not going as fast. Okay. So it actually turns out this is just an interpretation. This is understanding where the rule comes from. We can actually make this a formal asymptotic theory, should we want to. And when we do that, that's what these dotted lines are. So if we formally try and interpret the long time responses, we find that the radius does spread like t to the 3 quarters, and the width does spread like t to the half. Okay.
Is this structure seen in other gravity currents?
So that brings me on to this aside. So this is relating to what Jim just mentioned, that of course, if we're seeing this in these stratified gravity currents, they also auto-emerge in gravity currents within a uniform setting. So this would be if you just had a dense basal layer under a less dense ambient in a radial current driven by a constant flux. So now our governing equations in dimensional form, again I missed out the R here, this would now, G prime would be a constant because it's a constant compositional current. Okay, and again, if we were to do our naive scaling, we would expect that this should grow like time to the 3/4 power. But the point is, this isn't realized from the numerical solution when you actually take these and systematically integrate them. And here's a snapshot of what the height looks like, and indeed we get the same picture. The current lays down a steady tail and is connected to an unsteady region at the front via a shock.
This is because it's a radial geometry, it's not what you get in 2D.
It's not what you get in 2D. So in that sense, it is due to radial geometry. Actually, it's due to some conservation principles. So let me just get on to the next slide here. And it's because in the steady tail, you've got to conserve both mass flux and energy flow, and the energy that the flow has. And this poses an extra constraint. And so what we find for these these basal gravity currents is rather than t to the 3 quarters, we find t to the 4 fifths. Okay, and again, we can interpret that in actually trying to understand in detail what happens at the shock. So maybe we have the same balance that the shock speed basically moves like the front speed, and then balances between the momentum flux that comes from the back with the pressure at the front. And when we do that, we find that this h squared must go like 1 on r. The Froude number condition tells us front speed goes like root h. And so together we deduce that radius must go like 10 to the 4th.
How would you expect this to change if Jim already mentioned the entrainment at the shock at the back of the head, but the front also has a lot of entrainment associated with it? How would this change if you would allow entrainment into the head at the two shock locations?
So, the real answer is I don't know, and I don't think there have been enough experiments or even simulations in the radial geometry, maybe even a 2D geometry, to really answer that question succinctly. What we have learned from 2D is that actually, because in some sense the flow speed is set by the square root of density, g primed, times the height, that is conservative under entrainment. So if you dilute it by mixing, g prime goes down, but h goes up.
Yeah.
So in some sense, there's some forgiving in the problem, that if there's a bit of mixing, it doesn't take you miles away from the current. What might happen here, if you've got we've got an interior shock which is developing, so then it all depends, and we know that when you're actually, when we're actually close to the shock, the shallow layer equations are not telling us really what's happening here. All they're doing is saying that we're balancing fluxes between what's coming into this discontinuity and what's leaving. So the model is failing, really, at these shocks, and we're just kind of balancing it by input and output. And so it really depends as to whether processes which occur, non-shallow processes which occur over those length scales, actually significantly deviate the current from a shallow layer description. In other situations, they appear not to. But in this one, I don't think we know. But I think the point I'm trying to make here is that this is a situation where if you do what I'm calling naive scaling, it's kind of what everyone always does, you get the wrong answer. Okay. What are we doing? I should be trying to finish up. So I won't say anything about this. Okay, now we're going to think about what happens if we have wind. So we're going to look at the steady evolution under wind. And so we have mass conservation, I've lost the time derivative. We have downstream momentum, now acted upon by wind, which is due to the difference in velocity between the wind speed and the flow speed, and cross-stream momentum. Okay, and we can numerically solve these equations, and here are some simulations where the dimensionless wind speed was chosen to be 0.3. And Chris can tell you about how to do these in detail, these numerical simulations. And this would be pictures of the height field that you calculate. So the colors indicate the magnitude. And this is the downstream direction. And this is the cross stream. And so we find that these profiles start thick and they are thinned. And so under wind, we find that the effect of buoyancy is to produce a thinning layer.
Where's the thinning layer?
This is these contours, these colors are telling you the thickness, and so as you go downwind, the layer thickness is decreasing. Red being the thickest, blue being the thinnest. Okay. So we have this kind of layer which is thinning as you go downwind. Okay, and we're going to try and draw out some of the properties of that. And it turns out we can actually identify a regime where we can find something. So when you go far enough downstream, where the downstream distance is much greater than the cross-stream spreading, we can look in our momentum equations and deduce what are the dominant terms. And when we do this, we find in the downstream balance is that nothing as big as the downstream drag. And so the only way we can get a consistent balance there is to say that the flow has accelerated up to the wind speed, and so there's no component of drag. In the cross-stream, that continues to widen because there's a lateral pressure gradient, which in these terms is this first, this is h squared times dh by dy. That's wanting to push the flow sideways. And that has to be balanced by the lateral component of drag, which turns out to be just proportional to the the velocity sideways squared. And then we have fluid conservation. This is mass balance for the flowing layer. And then we have an expression of mass flux that W is the width. And so if we integrate, actually 2W is the width, if we integrate from 0 to W of the flux passing through U times H, we must get half of the mass flux. So this is a solution which will emerge when we're sufficiently far downstream that we've entered this dynamical balance. And when we do this, we find we can construct a similarity solution in this regime, where the height, or the thickness of the layer, decreases like a distance to the 1/3 power, and then has some shape, which is 1 minus y cubed over x to the 1/3, and the width increases like x to the 1/3.
This is a different h than the h we saw on the previous...
No, this is exactly this h. H is always the thickness of the layer. Okay, so this solution emerges when you get far downstream. Okay, and I've just repeated the solution, but re-putting it in dimensional form. And this is what it looks like. So this is the flows coming towards you, end on. We have a thickness here and a width. And as you go further downstream, this shape gets squashed in the thickness and expanded in the width. So we have, and the buoyancy process is a cloud which thins and widens. So here's a sketch of it. So again, this is the wind speed direction. So we have a cloud which thins and widens. And I draw this to contrast with the diffusion model, which had a cloud which, under diffusive processes, must broaden. Diffusion can do nothing other than that. But under buoyancy, it does the opposite. The point is, I'll say it again, that buoyancy processes are missing from the operational models for ash transport. Okay, so now particle transport. So, of course, these layers are transporting ash around, and it's ash which poses the hazard. The ash is so dilute that actually dynamically it's not affecting things. Its contribution to the overall density is weak. But nevertheless, we could calculate how it evolves. And this would be one way of doing it. So we would say we've got a volume fraction phi, and we're going to use the phi as then the kind of depth average, or the average of the volume fraction across the layer. And so it just satisfies an advection equation with settling. So it's a very simple model. It's just stirred up over this depth and settled over the bottom under gravity. Well, now, let's step back and say, well, let's think, what would be the steady solution if there were no wind? So in this case, if it's radially spreading, this becomes the radial divergence of the particle flux just settled under gravity. And because the volume flux is constant, this is a very simple solution, which doesn't depend on the dynamics at all, just depends on mass conservation, which tells you that the volume flux, the volume concentration decreases like the exponential of Vs r squared over q. This has been known for 20 years or so, and actually has been tested in experiments, and that's what I want to show you in the next slide. So here's some experiments where they had a plume source spreading, producing particles. The particles rained out onto the bed, and then the thickness of the deposit was measured to determine what was the overlying concentration. This is with no wind. And if you do the experiments with different particle sizes, you then have different settling velocities. And so, in particular, you can test whether this law is appropriate or not. So what we want to see is exponential decay going like Vs r squared over q. In the experiments, Vs is set by the particles, q by the source flux. And so we're just looking at whether it decays appropriately with r squared. And indeed, it seems to. So these are for 5 different particle sizes in the experiment. And then by working damn hard in the field, the volcanologists have also tested this in the Azores. So here's a volcano which erupted when there was negligible wind, or so it's thought. They go out and they dig up the deposit at various distances from the source and test for the... I guess, sieve the deposit to measure the particle sizes. And again, they find the same decay. So it seems as if this transport process has some basis in experimental and in field measurements. So of course, what we want to do is now couple it to the wind situation. In some ways, we've got lucky up to this stage. We haven't had to say anything about the dynamics of the layer. It's just been the mass conservation. But in our wind-affected solution, we've got to include U and V, which are the downwind and the crosswind velocities in the layer. So here's some numerical calculations. So this is, the arrows are kind of streamlines in the flow, and the colours give you magnitude of the log of the volume fraction. Okay, so this can be numerically computed. And then what we can do is downwind, sufficiently far downwind, we have this solution where we know what the height is, we know how the thickness varies with distance, and we know how the velocity varies with distance. We have that similarity solution. And so actually we can integrate this expression to work out how the volume fraction evolves. And here's our new rule. Rather than having exponential of minus Vs R squared over Q, we have something more complicated. Essentially along the midline, it's decaying like distance to the fourth times power. But this just comes from solving this equation with that similarity solution. Okay, so now I'm just going to summarize what we've done. So I think we tried to break this problem into two components, the rise part and the intrusion part. And our message in the first half is that you need to account for wind. Otherwise, you underestimate what the source flux is. So that's the first important message. The second important message is this, is that the plume delivers the particles at a certain height with a certain source flux. And these then get dispersed through the atmosphere. And the current models are only based on diffusive processes. And our contention is that buoyancy processes are important, at least within a certain distance within the volcano. So those are our two contentions. And maybe I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Will there be some more questions?
So in the tail, it's super critical. So there must be low Richardson numbers. So you'd expect quite a bit of mixing with the fluid, even if it's stably stratified above. And how important do you think that would be in reality?
Yes, you're right. I mean, the flow is has the potential to has enough kinetic energy that you could overturn the potential energy and mix. I think it's not known, really. I don't think there's good experiments of how this mixing would proceed in a stratified setting.
When you do these sort of DNS simulations, like Ecopus or Watson, and some, your currents, they always tend to just mix and disappear. It's hard to get currents that will last a long time as they disperse.
Yes. So one thing the atmospheric scientists would say is that mixed layers, or layers which have a uniform density, are pretty prevalent in the atmosphere. They occur often. The big difference between this is that it's a mixed layer driven by a sustained source. So other mixed layers that might have occurred might just have been some convective event just stirring something up. But here we're driving it continuously. And that's a bit different. I think that's a bit different because you were continually inputting material with this flux and with this certain energy. And that is different. As for how that would then mix as it progresses, I think we don't know yet. Presumably, actually, that's really how these flows experience drag.
Yeah.
So presumably, it's because...
That's what I'm thinking. It would change all the dynamics.
Yes, that's right.
You're putting in this quadratic drag, and that would be the same as...
That's right. That's right.
Accelerating entrained material.
Right. So presumably, that's its role, but it would also dilute the material in some way, and I don't think we... Or even a state to begin to work that out yet.
Thank you.
I was rather surprised at the very low particle loadings that you were suggesting for these for these intrusions. I would have expected, given the amount of ash accumulation that you get on the ground, that there would have been a substantial contribution to the buoyancy, and therefore that the buoyancy should be changing as the plume spreads. Is there any are there any environmental measurements to verify these?
So that had been exactly my expectation before we started working on this problem, that the actual cloud itself, the particles, would be substantially contributing to the density and so driving the flow. And then you have a rather interesting situation of as they settle out, the density is changing, and so you might change your vertical level, you change what neutral buoyancy means. It emerges from almost however we run these plume models that by the time you reach neutral buoyancy, the volumetric concentrations are down at 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. And so, the particles are 1,000 times denser than air, so perhaps 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 in terms of mass loading. But almost however we drive them, with almost whatever closures for mixing processes, the concentration ends up to be very small. So that's what's coming out of the models. Now, are there any experiment, are there any field observations? I think not good ones yet. So there are plans, and satellite retrieval techniques have improved, so people now potentially can begin to estimate concentrations by satellite signals. There's also plans during subsequent eruptions to drop devices through the cloud and try and collect particles in kind of a mini parachute, if you like. But I don't think at the moment there's any in situ measurements that are available at all. For us, I think the real realization was that even if there are no particles, you can still drive a flow, because what you're doing is you're stirring up the internal stratification, and that's then providing either you can view it as forces or you're stirring up potential energy, which is then released by the gravitational flow. And so in a way, particles might contribute, but we still nevertheless got this this internal stirring, which has and drive the flow.
In your models for the loss of particles due to settling, what do you assume for the settling velocity?
So, do you mean how is it related to particle size?
Right.
Yeah, so in particular for these comparisons, I guess in here, these particles would have been silicon carbide, so they're density about 3.2 or something. For the very finer ones, they're within the Stokes regime. Up here, I guess we'd be using... Actually, I think here we actually directly measured what the settling velocity was. But you could imagine having some drag rule or something.
Yeah.
Because the Reynolds number of these particles is becoming more than one. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any additional questions? Okay.
Concerning the spreading of the cloud, basically you were saying that I think the old models were kind of box models. We assume that the velocity is distributed evenly, and you're saying that the box model in itself is not adequate. You have to take into account the vertical structure of the head. Mm.
That's right. So well, actually, it's even at a stage pre-box model. So at least if you do a box model, you're properly writing down conservation principles. But in these kind of scaling approaches, people pretty happily write down, say, that the radius squared times the height must go like flux times time, or something, kind of an average, a representation of what volume conservation would mean. And this has been done essentially in the literature for the last 20 years or something. It actually turns out implicitly when you're doing that is that you are assuming this, there is time dependence throughout the whole domain, because you're assuming everything is varying in the same way. And I think what our realization is that just for these currents, and maybe for other situations, that's just not true.
I was actually thinking about the problem of, in Norway they have the problem of dredging out polluted soils from harbors and then dumping it further out. Mm. And the question is how the pollution spreads while they are dumping it. And tried to use a box model, but it seems like I could.
Well, so I think, of course, these box models sometimes work very well. And I think what we need to really understand is when that approach is appropriate and when it might fail. And here we found situations that it's for situations which are sustained, when you're continually inputting material, and you're asking, how does the unsteady front propagate? That, in a radial setting. Have we been in 2D, actually, the naive approach would have worked okay. So actually, it's to do with this. I'm skirting around something which I need to say more precisely. So, actually, this is a very recent revelation, at least revelation to Chris and Ian and Herb. So I'll do it in the context of these currents. So what we have at source is some flux. And then we also have some energy conservation. So in our context, it's stratified. And so our Bernoulli constant would be like u squared plus a quarter n squared h squared would be equal to some energy. And the point is that q and e have different dimensions in radial setting. If we were in 2D, we might write u times h being equal to a two-dimensional flux. Now I'm going to get myself in a mess here. What am I trying to say? N squared. And I guess here I really want to think about a buoyancy flux. I need an N here. Is that what I'm saying? Yeah, thank you. Right. Okay. So really, what we should view this is not the input of a flux, but the input of a buoyancy flux. So it's Q times N. Whereas this is an energy. N times Q and E have different dimensions. But in 2D, N times Q and E have dependent dimensions. They're both like a velocity squared. So actually, it turns out the naive scaling works in 2D because what you do, you pick up a ratio of Q over N over E. Whereas in here, by dimensional analysis, you're always going to have this extra parameter coming. So it's a combination of being steady and radial. So that may have said more than you wanted here, I don't know. But this is our understanding of it currently.
I've got a question for you. What about the feasibility of direct numerical simulations in the context of what Andy's talking about, at least for some of his problems?
I think DNS simulations would not be doable. The Reynolds number is too large. But perhaps one could do some large eddy type simulations of those kinds of things. And I'm wondering, the double diffusive settling that we talked about, if that might be relevant here. I'd like to talk to you more about that. I can maybe show you some.
Yes. And yes, in particular near source, where they do see sheets of particles coming right. Down. So yes, they will enhance sedimentation rates.
Okay, good. Well, if there are no more questions, thanks again.